Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinbergen? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm thrilled today to have with me Simon Reynolds. He's, to my mind, the consummate rock and roll critic. I've been reading him since his first book, Blissed Out. Now he's published Retromania, and rather than summarize myself, I've asked him to read from his introduction.
We live in a pop age gone loco for retro and crazy for commemoration. Band reformations and reunion tours, tribute albums and box sets, anniversary festivals and live performances of classic albums. Each new year is better than the last one for music from yesteryear. Could it be that the greatest danger to the future of our music culture is its past? Maybe that sounds unnecessarily apocalyptic, but the scenario I'm imagining isn't a cataclysm so much as a gradual wind down. This is the way that pop ends, not with a bang, but with a box set whose fourth disc you never get around to playing, and an overpriced ticket to the track-by-track restaging of the Pixies or Pavement album you played to death in your first year at college. Once upon a time, pop's metabolism buzzed with dynamic energy, creating the surging into the future feel of periods like the psychedelic 60s, the post-punk 70s, the hip-hop 80s, and the rave 90s. The 2000s felt different. Pitchfork critic Tim Finney noted the curious slowness with which this decade marches forward. He was specifically monitoring electronic dance music, which all through the 90s had been pop culture's vanguard, hurling forth a new next big thing every season. But Finney's observation can be applied not just to dance music but to popular music in its entirety. The sensation of moving forward grew fainter as the decade unfurled. Time itself seemed to become sluggish, like a river that starts to meander and form oxbow lakes. If the pulse of now felt weaker with each passing year, that's because in the 2000s, the pop present became ever more crowded out by the past, whether in the form of archived memories of yesteryear or retro rock leeching off ancient styles. Instead of being about itself, the 2000s has been about every other previous decade happening all at once, a simultaneity of pop time that abolishes history while nibbling away at the present's own sense of itself as an era with a distinct identity and feel. Instead of being the threshold to the future, the first 10 years of the 21st century turned out to be the re-decade. The 2000s were dominated by the re-prefix, revivals, reissues, remakes, reenactments, endless retrospection. Every year brought a fresh spate of anniversaries with their attendant glut of biographies, memoirs, rockumentaries, biopics, and commemorative issues of magazines. Then there were the band reformations, whether it was groups reuniting for nostalgia tours in order to replenish or to bloat still further the members' bank balances, Police, Led Zeppelin, Pixies, the list is endless, or as a prequel to returning to the studio to relaunch their careers as recording artists, the Stooges, Throbbing Gristle, Devo, Fleetwood Mac, My Bloody Valentine, et al. If only it was just the old music and old musicians coming back in archived form or as reanimated performers. But the 2000s was also the decade of rampant recycling. Bygone genres revived and renovated. Vintage sonic material reprocessed and recombined. Too often with new young bands, beneath their taut skin and rosy cheeks, you could detect the sagging grey flesh of old ideas.
My guest is Simon Reynolds. He is the author of Blissed Out, The Raptures of Rock, The Sex Revolts, Gender, Rebellion, and Rock and Roll, Energy Flash, A Journey Through Rave Music and Dance Culture, Rip It Up and Start Again, Post-Punk, 1978 to 1984, Bring the Noise, 20 Years of Writing About Hip Rock and Hip Hop, at Totally Wired, Post-Punk Interviews and Overviews, and now Retromania. Retromania is published by Faber & Faber. The earlier books are being reissued by Akashic, and it's a great pleasure to have Simon Reynolds to explain to someone like me, who's basically been interested but a voyeur, to music. You know, there for years at the Starwood or the Whiskey, everywhere along the strip. But gradually you get older, you disappear, and you need Simon Reynolds to explain what's happening to you. Look at this show as a compendium companion piece to Morning Becomes Eclectic, because, you know, when I listen, what I hear now that I've read Simon's book is Retromania, the balancing and mixing of dozens and dozens of kinds of music. Now, you see this more as cause for despair and even a kind of ho-hum rather than, oh boy, more mix. Why?
I think one of the things I've always looked for from pop music is a sense of surprise, you know, of things that have sort of come out of the blue. And you can't really place them, and you're kind of disoriented. And when you have so much music that is sort of plotted on a kind of map of influences and references and sources, you don't get that sort of feeling of unfamiliarity. You don't get that feeling of the future emerging. And so that's what I've kind of been missing in music. Well, at the same time, I do enjoy a lot of the music that is so heavily based on the past, and I enjoy the kind of witty games it plays with the past. There is good music that comes out of this sort of condition of retromania, but it isn't really as surprising as the first time that you heard, I don't know, Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles, or Isn't Anything by My Bloody Valentine, or, you know, the first hip-hop records, the first techno records, seem like they were completely unprecedented.
Now, Retromania, a lot of people would say it's the same thing in fashion. And me, when I read Retromania, the book by my guest Simon Reynolds, I said, oh, well, this is what I worry about with modern poetry, that we've reached a point where the copying of earlier styles, the transformation into dissonance and nonsense, how much further can we go before we hit an original new style? So fashion, music, poetry, the novel, probably modern art, all of these ideas are being advanced in art schools about how to work the past. What do you feel? Are we stuck with this for the rest of our lives?
That's what kind of worries me. That's my kind of that's where the element of gloom comes in, is the idea that, you know, right now a lot of people are talking about a 90s revival in music, and it just seems so predictable that as the calendar ticks along, you know at some point there will be a revival of the noughties, or, you know, whatever we're agreeing to call the last decade in music, and
the zeros,
the aughts, you know, or whatever. But yeah, you're right. It's a culture-wide paradigm, and particularly strong in the world of fashion and design, you know, graphic design, interior design. There's an awful lot of these twin sort of things of the retro, like recycling old ideas, and then vintage is the other thing that is a really huge sort of phenomenon, and an enjoyable phenomenon. But I think it's interesting, you know, to put it in sort of cliched terms. In the 60s, you know, hipsters might have had a lava lamp. Now hipsters probably on their living room table have a manual typewriter, you know, a sort of antique. That seems a profound – it's a trivial example, but it's also points to a profound cultural shift, I think.
But it's interesting to me that you say to express it in a cliched way, because one of the things that's true about retro culture is to say we love cliches. We're going to use cliches as a form of irony, sometimes as a form of wit, but cliché becomes, in a way, and quotation, more vibrant than original expression. How have we reached this pass, and why?
I think, you know, perhaps it could be that it's just the inevitable upshot of the 20th century moving so fast. There was such a particular, you know, particularly the 60s is a super fast decade. But, you know, basically most decades of the 20th century, there's an incredible accelerated turnover of trends, new things being invented in every art form. And it's built up this mountainous heap of stuff behind us. And it's very tempting, I think, for new artists to sort of go to the heap and sift through it and find something, kind of tinker with it a bit, change it slightly, or do an outright impersonation of it, you know.
I'm talking to Simon Reynolds about his new book, Retromania, which, of course, is tracking the, in a sense, untrackable, the way the first years of this century become a replay of everything before them. And he makes the claim that this is the first time nostalgia addresses things in living memory. We're not thinking back to the dance bands of the 30s and 40s. We're thinking back to the bands that informed our own 20s and 30s. Suddenly, we're living in the yearning for our own past rather than the past of an old movie or an old Sinatra record. Why do people, given the fact that childhood might be the most horrible part of life, why do people yearn for their childhoods?
Just generally in terms of like nostalgia, I think it's a human trait, and it's also a grand cultural trait. If you look at the history of humanity, often societies conceive themselves as fallen in some way, like inferior to some golden age. Usually, though, they're way back, you know, so the Renaissance looks to classical era, or it's like a completely mythological time that didn't actually exist, but, you know, like people feel like there was natural order and the just kings and no one was hungry and all that kind of stuff. Often revolutionary movements in the Middle Ages often had this idea of we're going to restore things to how they were.
Yeah. Ariel Pink is an artist that you like who's been performing now. What's his relation to the past in music?
Well, the music he's been making for about 10 or 12 years now, he really got prominence in the middle of the last decade when early obscure things he'd only released on cassette and were given a proper release as compact discs. His whole thing is, you know, he's very inspired by the past, and he kind of, the music that made him famous had a lot of kind of deliberate lo-fi blurriness and hiss, and it was almost as though he was trying to recreate this primal scene of the child who has discovered pop music is spellbound with one ear to, you know, a slightly out of tune transistor radio. So the signal is, you know, blurred, but you get this sort of sense of this transcendent wonderland of pop. And I think that seemed to be what he was perhaps unconsciously trying to do. But he talked about it wasn't so much radio that inspired him, it was MTV. And he even said to me, MTV was my babysitter. So you listen to his music and you hear 70s sort of radio rock, soft rock, and I hear the, you know, the Blue Oyster Cult or all kinds of bands from that era. And then you also hear 80s sort of new wave and synth pop in there. So it's just, there's a profound, a really, you know, a real halcyon sense of the golden age of pop. It's like pop music that's in love with pop, meta pop in a sense, but with a real emotional kick, I think.
What are we going to hear by Ariel Pink?
This is a song called from his most recent album, where he kind of stripped away some of the haze and distortion and the sort of blurry memory effect. But it's still, it's called Can't Hear My Eyes, and it's still very much like evocative of radio wonderland of the past.
So beautiful, hey, hey, hey.
don't be afraid. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Simon Reynolds about his book, Retromania. We'll be back after this brief break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Simon Reynolds about his new book, Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past, a sharp, in-depth look at our music culture's obsession with its own immediate past and what it means for the future. Now, we just heard Ariel Pink, and you've also brought us a song that is an influence, an undertone of the song. What is that?
It's from Fleetwood Mac's Tusk album from 1979. It's a track written and sung by Christy McVie called Brown Eyes.
Let's hear it. Fleetwood Mac, Brown Eyes. Now tell me, what's the relationship?
I think Ariel Pink with Can't Hear My Eyes is inspired by that sort of general era of sort of California, Southern California soft rock. But also the just music of that time. So maybe things like Jerry Rafferty, Baker Street, music that was very kind of mellow, had a sort of kind of fey longing and sad sort of sad sensuality to it, and there's a reference to, you know, in the lyrics to the sunset on the strip, so that's obviously helping to cue further the sort of associations of particular era of music when punk didn't really happen on a mainstream level in America. What did was, you know, Fleetwood Mac and bands like that, and there's a certain kind of, it's become quite fashionable in underground music scenes to refer back to soft rock, even though that was kind of the antithesis of, you know, where indie rock and post-punk music came from. It was actually considered the enemy. There's been this kind of almost perverse fascination for sort of slick, mellow, laid-back, very sort of well-played music.
Because my subject ultimately is always writing, one of the things that I notice, particularly in this book, but if I go across your career, you've managed to sample in your own writing,
right,
the sounds and nature of the music you're writing about. That is to say, a rock critic has to be, in prose, a gifted mimic. And Grill Marcus once told me that he was angry at me for getting the basement tapes of Dylan to read with his Dylan book because he wanted the prose to do it. How did you teach yourself to write about music in a way that would be strong enough to bring the music into the reader's head?
I'm not really sure how. I read an awful lot of music writing, and I was really inspired by particularly the British music press, and I probably learned from writers like Barney Hoskins and Paul Morley about, you know, sort of tricks you can use to sort of bring across the musicality, the music comes out in a certain musicality in your writing. And I when I'm at my weakest, I lapse into adjectives. But I think I always follow this thing that Barney Hoskins actually wrote about. I think he might have borrowed the idea from Roland Barthes, but the idea is that adjectives are the weakest way of conveying anything. You want to sort of somehow personify the music or make it into a thing, you know, or a landscape, something, you know, something that creates a picture. So I might write about music and try and use a sort of nature world or geographical kind of imagery, or make it a track seem like a machine that's doing something or going somewhere, like a vehicle. Or just if you do have to use adjectives, and you kind of try and do them in ways that kind of clash and create some kind of unusual reverberations.
My college roommates back in Buffalo were both rock critics. Joe Fernbacher, now dead, who wrote for Cream and Crawdaddy. Billy Altman, who not only did the first biography of Robert Benchley, but he, you know, just one of the new careers, curates a rock and roll museum. New career for the past, future. For them, reading rock criticism was like taking a hit. And Susan Sontag used to say, I want to take a hit of René Girard. Yeah. To what extent are you aware that the writing needs to have the energy and transformative spirit of taking a drug?
Well, that's the way it's often worked for me. And whether it was reading these people in the British music papers like the NME when I was growing up, or reading Roland Barthes, Foucault, all those sort of French theory people, or reading Sontag actually was had this similar effect on me. You get a combination, you know, it depends on the writer, but you can get a sort of just a clarity that is like amphetamine, where just, you know, you're infused with energy and focus and everything becomes clear, and you have that sense that, you know, eureka, I can see things. Also, you know, but other times, you know, great music writing can be almost psychedelic. You know, it can kind of create mental pictures, and, you know, it brings out the side of music, you know, it accompanies the side of music that itself is a little bit synesthetic and a little bit hallucinatory.
Retromania, by my guest Simon Reynolds, is encased with something called the Retroscape. It begins in 2000 and ends in the future, and it's a kind of list of retro, which verges into retro fantasy. I thought we'd close out with a rather hallucinatory list of what retro can be.
2010, October. It's announced that Sacha Baron Cohen of Ali G and Borat fame is to play the role of Freddie Mercury in an upcoming biopic of the Queen singer's life. 2010, October. Retro soul producer Mark Ronson of Amy Winehouse fame switches to ransacking the 80s with his new album Record Collection, featuring cameo vocals from Simon Le Bon and Boy George. 2010, October. 27 years after the fact, LaRue's Ellie Jackson declares that 80s synth pop is so over. It was my thing and I'm bored with it. I don't want to make synth music for the rest of my life. If I see anything more 80s themed, I'm going to bust. 2010, November. Bruce Springsteen takes the deluxe expanded reissue to the nutty next level with The Promise, a 3-CD and 3-DVD inflation of his 1978 album Darkness on the Edge of Town, encompassing a documentary on the record's making, reproductions of the Boss's notebooks, performance footage, a concert film, and outtakes galore.
I've been talking with Simon Reynolds, author most recently of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. You've just heard a bit of a retromanic fantasy as the past overcomes the present and the future. The book is published by Faber and Faber. Thank you, Simon, for joining me.
2011, January. Rhino Records announced a 60-disc box set documenting every single live performance of the Grateful Dead's 1972 European tour. All 7,200 copies of the $450 limited edition sell out in advance in a few hours.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz.
2011, June. 80s nostalgia promoters Here and Now celebrate their 10th anniversary with a UK tour featuring Boy George, Jimmy Somerville, Midge Ure, A Flock of Seagulls, Jason Donovan, Jean Baudrillard, and Pepsi and Shirley. 2011 summer, Dennis Wilson biopic, released to coincide with the Beach Boys' 50th anniversary. 2011 October, The Lost Generation All-Stars tour of UK post-rockers, Disco Inferno, Moonshake, Long Fin Killy, Crescent, Third Eye Foundation, plays 17 dates across Britain. 2011 November, Facebook campaign to persuade Iggy Pop to keep his shirt on tops 4 million signatures. 2011 December, Julian Temple unexpectedly turns his punk documentary trilogy into a tetraology with So What, a film about the Anti-Nowhere League. 2012 January, It's Trad Dad, Shane Meadows' movie about Britain's revival jazz scene of the 50s, opens, starring Julian Barrett as Ken Collier and David Mitchell as George Melly. 2012 April, Culture Club reformed to play celebration gig for the 30th anniversary of their first single, White Boy. 2012 Summer, a reformed Stone Roses headline one night at the Glastonbury Festival, with In Spiral's Carpet guitarist Graham Lambert subbing for John Squire, who declines to participate.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.